Hello, welcome everybody to the live seminar, A New Direction for Printers and Packagers, How to Capitalize on Current M&A Trends, presented by New Direction Partners and powered by Printing Impressions and Package Printing. I'm Stu Margolis, partner of Margolis Partners, CPA firm, and I'm pleased to welcome you today for this event. Before we get started, I have some technology pointers for you, some quick tips. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking in the help widget at the bottom of your console marked with a question mark. Or you may be able to, you should be able to submit a Q&A, request for help in the Q&A box. You also have the Q&A box to submit your questions today to today's panelist. And we are certainly encouraging you to do so. We'll be addressing selected questions during and at the end of the hour, so please send them anytime you wish. Also, make sure you've turned off any pop-up lockers on your computer so you can utilize all the widgets and bells and whistles that go along with this great console. And lastly, click on Tips for Attendees widget below to learn all the widgets on this, what they can do, all these widgets can do, and how you can customize them for your experience today. Today, we're here to discuss M&A trends. We have Peter Schaefer, a partner in New Directions Partners, and Paul Riley, another partner in New Direction Partners. Peter is an experienced deal maker with 20 years of investment banking experience and valuation experience. He has closed more than 100 transactions in virtually every segment of the printing industry, as well as the sale of a $75 million helicopter company and a $10 million bread manufacturer. We're proud to have him. Almost all of his experience is in the printing industry. And Paul Wright, I just had to add those two things in, Peter. Sorry.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Stu.
And Paul Riley, prior to his New Direction Partners, was a chief executive officer and president and chairman of the board of directors at Senveo Corporation, or Inc., I should say, one of North America's leading printing firms. During his 10 years at Senveo, he grew income revenue from $17 million to $2 billion, that's B, in sales, with more than 10,000 customers and 86 plants. Offices all through North America. So, without further delay, I'd like to introduce Paul and Peter. So the floor is yours.
Okay.
I apologize. I did not move forward our slides here, so why don't I get them forward for you.
Thank you, Stu. Thank you, everyone. Good afternoon. And Stu, in honor of that introduction that you gave, I am going to strive to figure out how to inject stories about that bread manufacturer and that helicopter company that I worked at.
You can remember back 20 years. Good luck.
So, hi again to everyone. Paul and I are delighted to be here. And what we're going to talk about today, our agenda, our objectives will be to really talk about trends that we're seeing in M&A in both the printing and the packaging industries. We're going to talk about what has been happening, what's currently happening, and what we expect to happen going forward. In addition, we'll talk about some topics that people seem to enjoy talking about, and that would be multiples that we're seeing being paid for both printing and packaging companies, what segments within each of those industries are receiving premiums, what segments are not receiving premiums and, in fact, being perhaps penalized. And then we'll also talk about the three different types of transactions that we're seeing, and we'll finally show a chart or a table demonstrating why an acquisition is so attractive from a quantitative or numerical perspective. And then finally, at the end, we have a few pages just over the years, qualitative aspects that we've accumulated, or characteristics, I should say, that are attractive if you're a seller, and then conversely, characteristics that would not be attractive or that would reward you with a lower purchase price if you were thinking of selling. So we'll cover that at the end. So, oh, I'm sorry, Paul. I will turn it over to you.
Okay. So as a packaging or printing company looks at the options, the strategic options that are in front of them, there's this imperative to grow. And there are several options available, and you probably can't do them all. You can do a couple. So they include things like organic or internal growth. And it's important to note there are many segments, many sub-markets within the printing area that are not growing. And that actually drives more and more people to be looking at an M&A acquisition. So options. You can grow organically through internal growth. You can look at new products. You can do the famous do nothing. And interestingly, we see a lot of people just absolutely frozen by what's going on in the marketplace, and they're waiting and seeing. Option is that you can merge with a competitor. You don't have to buy somebody. Two companies can get together. And another one is that you purchase a competitor. So that's the ways that companies can grow. We go to the next slide. If you're not growing, what should you do? There is the do-nothing option. Be a survivor and figure it out later. There are many people waiting for the heyday of the 90s to come back, and it just doesn't appear that's going to be. So that leaves us with, if you're going to grow, you could certainly look at merging or acquiring another company, or if you decided you're not going to grow, you become a seller. And this is why Peter and I frequently talk to groups and say we find people are rightly either an acquirer, they're a buyer, or they're selling or preparing their company for sale. And we would recommend that each and every one of you give that some thought. Which of those two makes sense? Certainly if you're in a market that's not growing. So let me pass it back to Peter.
So in this economy, it really has become survival of the fittest. And as Paul said, one option is to do nothing. But what we're seeing more and more today, and this is not only in these two industries, printing and packaging, it's really true in any industry, and that is that today almost everyone's either a buyer or a seller. It used to be that organic growth was much easier than it is today. And in many segments of the industries today, people feel that growth by acquisition is easier than organic growth. So really, we're in a society where almost everybody is either a buyer or a seller. And we do believe, and we'll get to this in more detail later on in the presentation, but we believe that the consolidation trend that we're seeing today is going to continue. Even if, and certainly we hope this won't be the case, but even if there were to be another economic catastrophe, the types of transactions that we're seeing today, we would expect to continue to be seen just because growth by acquisition is so easy. So the types of transactions we're seeing today, there are really three types of transactions. Number one would be the traditional cash at closing, multiple of earnings type transaction. Great way to sell your company if you can. And to do that, you need to have a certain amount of earnings and growth and et cetera. And we'll get into that in more detail as we talk more about that approach. Another type of transaction that we have been seeing for now a number of years is what's called a tuck-in. and we'll talk about each of these three in more detail. But a tuck-in is basically where one competitor is buying the book of business of another competitor and moving that business or that those sales into their own facility. And then finally, we'll talk about what we call cashless mergers. It can also be called merger of equals, but that's very similar to a tuck-in type transaction, but it's where the two firms become owners of the new combined company. But first, we're going to talk about the traditional earnings-based type of transaction, and that is, again, where you're paid a multiple of your earnings in cash at closing, and typically, almost all the time when these types of transactions occur, it's going to be a multiple applied to the company or the seller's most recent EBITDA. And many of you, I'm sure, have heard of the term EBITDA. In case you have not, it stands for earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. It's basically your operating cash flow. And companies in printing and packaging that are selling for a multiple of EBITDA or earnings always sell off their EBITDA. But what we're finding is actually it's not strictly these industries. Any industry buyers are looking at your EBITDA. And there are some fundamental theoretical reasons as to why buyers believe that's the best parameter to look at. But basically, it's removing any disparities between one company to another company, so you're really looking at an apples-to-apples comparison.
Yep. Peter, I would add here that I think we could all, many people that are on the conference today, could talk about what's wrong with EBITDA. And there are things wrong with it. But nonetheless, it's what the world is used. If you're borrowing money today and that your debt as a function of EBITDA will be looked at very, very strongly by your bankers. So it's a metric that has several flaws, but it's here to stay. And there are other maybe methods that we all consider better, but nonetheless, it's something that you should familiarize yourself with. The one item I would probably add here is that there are times when you're computing EBITDA that, particularly with family-owned businesses, there may be what we call add-backs. And the add-backs could be a variety of things. It could be personal expenses. It could be expenses that exist because it is owned by a particular family. And they get added to make these numbers a little bit higher. Sometimes it can go the opposite way as well. But we want to let you know that a lot of problems, but learn about the metric because most people you're going to be dealing with want to talk to you today about EBITDA.
So if you take a look at this slide, we're doing a hypothetical example here. This is a $12 million company. And if you see how we're computing EBITDA, we're starting with what we call adjusted pre-tax income. So that's your bottom line pre-tax profit plus the adjustments that Paul just talked about. And the typical add-backs, just being even a little more specific than what Paul was saying, would be that we see in almost every transaction is excess shareholders' compensation. And sometimes it goes the other way, as Paul said. Sometimes the shareholders' compensation is below market. But the biggest adjustment is reflecting shareholder compensation to market. Another one would be if in an outside partnership you own the building, your lease payments might not be at market. So you would reflect that, board of directors' fees, et cetera. But you take that adjusted pre-tax profit, you add back the net interest expense, you add back your depreciation expense, and that gives you EBITDA. So in this example, again, $12 million company, and we're showing an EBITDA of $1.1 million, which is very close to 10%, which is about average to above average in the printing industry today. It used to be that profit leaders were at 20% EBITDA margins, then it dropped to 15, then 10, then lower back during the awful days of 2009, 2010, and it's gone up since then. And it would be a little higher in the packaging side. It would be probably closer to 15%. But if you take that EBITDA of $1.1 million and then to figure out the purchase price, you would take the multiple, which in this instance we've picked a hypothetical multiple of 4x. We'll get into the actual multiples a little further down, but there are certainly segments within both printing and packaging that a 4 multiple would be a very reasonable, realistic multiple. So you take the 4, you multiply that by 1.1, that gives you what we call the enterprise value, $4.4 million. Unfortunately, that's not what goes in your pocket, because buyers today will buy companies on what they call a debt-free and cash-free basis is the most typical. So you take that $4 million, and you do get to keep the cash on the books, but you also need to pay off all the interest-bearing debt. So if you have line of credit, capitalized leases, notes payable, both short and long-term, that would be subtracted. So, again, in this hypothetical example, we have a $12 million company. We're assuming that it had $2 million in debt. You subtract that from the 4.4, and that gives you an equity value of $2.4 million.
Yeah, Peter, if I could add here, we frequently get asked a question by people when they do an EBITDA calculation, do they keep receivables and inventory? And the answer is no. That the if your business is being priced as a multiple of EBITDA and you are provided an enterprise value, that means that the receivables, inventory, goes with the buyer. So you don't get to add to this number the value of your receivables or inventory.
Paul, you're absolutely right. But also you bear in mind the trade liabilities, such as the accounts payable, will be assumed by the buyer.
Correct.
So the best way you look at it is all the working capital, except for the cash and the short-term debt, all the working capital stays with the buyer. There is a tracking mechanism with most buyers where they will track your working capital from where they initially priced it up until closing. And if your working capital is above average, there will usually be a positive working capital adjustment where you'll get that difference. But on the other hand, if the working capital drops below the average, that would be a decrease to the purchase price. So this next slide is overall in both printing and packaging. This shows the multiples of EBITDA that we see having been paid for companies, privately held companies, from today back until 2006. The white part of the graph would represent the printing multiple, and the yellow part would represent the premium that we see going to the packaging industries. And there hasn't always been a premium. For example, in 2009, you can see there was almost no premium being assigned if you were a packaging company. But really, since then in particular, there has been a premium each year, and that is just because overall that industry is growing at a much more healthy pace than printing. And in general, again, those margins for packaging companies are higher. So what we're saying is in 2013, and so far year-to-date in 2014, we are seeing printing companies being priced at a maximum EBITDA value of 5.75x EBITDA. And we'll get into a little later what type of companies would command that premium multiple of 5.7, but then we're also saying that the premium packaging companies could command another 0.75 point up to 6.5 times EBITDA. And the next chart is a lot of the same information, but it's just showing the premium again going to packaging. And on this line chart, the bottom line, the solid white line, would represent the very low end of the range of multiples being paid for either printing or packaging companies. These are typically companies that if they're in printing, for example, they would be in one of the segments that would be declining, such as maybe the general commercial segment or books. They would command a lower end of the range in terms of an EBITDA multiple, and it would be the same for packaging. And it would not only be the range that they're in, it could be their size would warrant a lower multiple, or their lack of profitability or customer concentration. There are a whole bunch of issues that would dictate what multiple is ultimately paid. But then the top two lines, the dashed lines, would be the white line would be the printing industry, and the yellow line would be the packaging.
Peter, if I could add here, not only within printing and packaging, but across all segments of our economy, that there are two major, they're not the only, but there are two major drivers of EBITDA. The first one is top line and bottom line growth. You know, historically and in the future, what is going to happen? And if the assumption is and the history is that both top line and bottom line profits are going to grow, that industry is given a higher multiple. So clearly the difference between printing and packaging is the differences we're looking at here are almost always due to the difference in growth rates between the two segments of the industry. The other item that increases value is the size of the transaction. And this may not seem intuitive to people, but the larger the transaction, usually the higher the EBITDA multiple. And it's actually technical. There is more demand for larger transaction than there is for smaller transactions. And for many, many years, it's easier to raise $15 million than it is $1.5 million. So that's the dynamics that drives these EBITDA multiples over a long period of time, both within our industry and within other industries.
I totally agree. And going even a step further, in packaging and printing, the multiples being paid for private companies are largely being driven by the multiples that the public companies in those sectors are trading at. And the multiples that they're trading at is strictly due to the growth that they're able to show their analysts. So going back to what Paul was saying, and I agree completely, the packaging stocks are showing higher growth rates than the printing stocks. So therefore, they're trading at a higher multiple, and they are able to pay a higher multiple when they buy companies, because if they were to ever pay more than the multiple they're trading at, it would be dilutive, and they would actually lose money the day they close on a transaction. Instead, they want it to be accretive, where they will be making money.
Stuart, I see that you got some questions here.
Yeah, I think this would be a good opportunity to ask two questions. First question for you, Paul. As you had mentioned that there's flaws in EBITDA calculation, but that, you know, we're essentially fighting an uphill battle, everybody's using EBITDA. Can you just discuss what the flaws are in EBITDA, just in a theoretical sense, so that some of the people who are listening would understand that?
So the major flaw, I mean, there are several, but the major flaw in EBITDA is looking at CapEx. If you look at an EBITDA calculation, what is really missing relative, or the big part that's missing relative to true cash flow, is how much is being invested in capital expenditures, what we call CapEx. So if you're in an industry that has a large CapEx compared to an industry that has a smaller CapEx, sometimes that's not reflected. I would even argue within our industry, companies that have invested in CapEx and they have less in the future, that they tend not to be – they get some benefit from that, but not as much as they should. So the biggest floor, it happens to be CapEx. The next biggest floor happens to be working capital and how much money you need to put into the company to support its growth. But that's what's missing.
Yeah, it really comes down to balance sheet requirements. And the reason they came up with EBITDA was it added back the two biggest discrepancies between privately held companies. One would be different debt structures or capital structures, and you're removing that distortion by adding back the interest expense. And the other would be companies that have different depreciation policies. Some try to depreciate their equipment very quickly. Some try to do it over a longer period of time. So adding that back removes the discrepancy. Not too long ago, maybe 5 years ago, a lot of private equity buyers tried to take EBITDA and turn it into EBITDAR, where they were adding back rent expense also, because that, if you think about it, companies, some companies own their own buildings, some companies don't. So adding back rent expense would remove that distortion as well. It didn't really go anywhere. But what they do look at today, as we already talked about in the adjustments, is you do normalize the lease payments or the rent payments. So in effect, you are almost looking at an EBITDAR.
Well, thank you. Let me ask one more question to Peter. Peter, you were talking about working capital, and it's changed, let's say, from the moment you reach a deal to settlement. But what happens if a company, a printing company, has either an extremely large working capital amount, sort of ordinate for its size, or let's just say a minimal working capital environment when you go to buy it? Is there any adjustments to the selling price or the buying price?
Typically, there will be an adjustment due to the normal fluctuations of the working capital. If you have a company that has too little working capital, rather than there being a decrease to the purchase price just for that reason, typically we'll see a lower multiple being paid for the company. Or if the company has a very high working capital, where there's a surplus, typically, again, that's going to be reflected in the multiple, and that's one of the reasons why a buyer will pay a premium at closing. So you can't necessarily have your cake and eat it, too, where you get a higher multiple and then you get all the excess working capital back.
Well, thank you. And why don't you move on then, and we're good. Thank you.
So this next slide is where we're talking about the multiples being paid for sellers within printing and packaging. But we all know within both industries there are some segments that are going to be more attractive than others. And this is certainly not an all-inclusive list, but these are the segments within both industries that we are seeing great interest in among buyers today. On the printing side, there's tremendous interest right now for large format POP type companies that are printing for the retail sectors or the fast food chains. Our company has sold, I believe, 5 of those businesses within the last 2 years and just received very strong interest within the buyers. In addition to that, I specifically pointed out that the general commercial segment is not as attractive today as it had been, and that is certainly true. But there are certain general commercial companies that over the years have recognized that they can shift away from the highly competitive transactional type business by taking on more program IT-driven business. And those companies that have been successful in generating program-type accounts are also getting premium multiples today. we have seen a number of transactions close recently where our clients have had, in one instance, they had more than 50% of their business was being driven by program-type business. Another instance that we have currently, it's 90%. And those companies are getting much higher multiples than they would if they did not have that program business. Digital, web-to-print, customized direct marketing, all of those would be very healthy segments within the printing industry. And even non-printers are attractive right now to buyers, such as data analytics companies and even creative agencies. We've seen a number of very forward-thinking printing companies take a look at those types of businesses. On the packaging side, we're seeing tremendous interest within flexible packaging and label segments. Multiples very high for those businesses. And, again, it mostly comes back to growth. We're seeing tremendous growth in those two segments. Pharmaceutical packaging, we've sold a number of those businesses, and those are generating a lot of interest still today at premium multiples and folding cartons as well.
And I would just add that the reason why these companies tend to be hot is that because they are growing. These are segments that are growing faster than the average segments in these industries. And if your business is one of those, you are growing faster than your competitors, it will be considered a premium segment.
Just as an example, we have a flexible packaging client right now that's generating between 40 and 50% organic growth year after year now, and that is certainly well above packaging as a whole. And as you can imagine, the multiples being offered for that business are quite high.
Okay, so
Paul, I think I'm going to turn it back to you.
We're going to now talk about a different type of transaction. But before we do so, the prior transaction was one that was based, and the purchase price is based on a function of EBITDA. 3 or 4 years ago, we actually saw very little of those. Most of the transactions were being completed were prices of as tuck-ins. But there's a couple of events. It's very important that we point out that today's market is fairly robust. And we are seeing a lot of companies moving and coming to the M&A market. And very, very interesting, for the first time in a long time, we are seeing private equity come back very, very strongly into our markets. And it's a very good sign. Private equity people, they like the other. They're only going to deal in the EBITDA multiple methods. They're not going to get involved in tuck-ins. The people that get involved in tuck-in transactions are almost always the buyer is a strategic buyer, somebody that's in the business already. So let me talk a bit about tuck-ins. So tuck-ins is really another way of saying the purchase price is based on the market value of the underlying assets plus some amount of goodwill that's attributable to the customer base. So generally speaking, when you compute the value of a company under an EBITDA method, you also would do it under a tuck-in or asset value method. And generally speaking, whatever is highest – is the value of to the seller. Now, I say generally, if the two are very, very far apart, the one that is higher, that price gets dampened a bit. So what tuck-ins became fairly prevalent during the last downturn in the economy, the 2008, 9, 10 period, when almost every transaction that New Directions worked on was priced in that manner. The keys for success of a tuck-in, though, is that the customers can be moved 95% of the time, the customers get moved from the seller to the buyer's operation. And it's that post-operational method of how the company is going to be run is what drives a tuck-in system to work. So things like customer portability important. The companies will need to merge. The way they go to market needs to merge. One of the key factors for success is that when you are transferring the business from one company to the other, that there are no changes in account representation during that transitional period. And manufacturing integration is really, really key. If there is a hurdle to the execution of the tuck-in, frequently it revolves around real estate, where the real estate is a situation where the plant to be abandoned, again, usually the seller's plant to be abandoned, is, does that plant have value? Is there an ongoing lease that has to be paid? Sometimes the inability to find another use for that facility is what stops a deal from getting done.
Paul, I would just add, there is no doubt from a buyer's perspective the tuck-in is incredibly attractive because it enables you to fill up your excess capacity. You already have the fixed costs in place, so you're only having incremental variable expenses. So it's a beautiful thing. The difficulty is just what Paul alluded to. If you have building or too much debt that needs to be paid down at closing, frequently the buyer will need to work with the seller in order to enable the seller to sell by this method. So you do need to be creative. Sorry, Paul.
Okay, so generally there are three pieces of the purchase price of a tuck-in. First has to do with the purchase of accounts receivable, inventory, assumption of accounts payable. Normally, that value is purchased by the buyer at closing or remains with the seller and they realize the book value. It's almost immaterial relative to the seller if the accounts receivable or inventory and liabilities or, you know, accounts payable gets assumed. We would highly recommend, though, for both when we both represent a buyer and a seller, is that the buyer picks up at least the management of those so that there is little impact on from the customer's perspective and how the business is being run. So first part of a tuck-in, the value of working capital, normally at book value. I would add that under almost all cases, the realization of accounts receivable and inventory is guaranteed by the seller. The second piece has to do with assets that the buyer may need. And it tends to be a pick and choose. You know, what are the assets that the buyer needs to continue to run this business in their facility? I have been always saying, I'm making the assumption that that we're moving the business to the buyer's facility. That's, in fact, the case most of the time, but not all the time. I mean, Peter and I were involved in a transaction not so long ago where actually the transaction was put together in this manner, but the seller's facility was the one that got continued because it was a better facility than the one the buyer had. So the third piece is what equipment gets purchased by the buyer. And the purchase price here tends to be somewhere between an orderly liquidation value or a forced liquidation value, but it's a price that the buyer would or the seller would realize if they were liquidating the company. So if you just think about the two items ongoing, working capital and equipment being purchased as liquidation value, that's the value that a tuck-in starts. On top of that, though, the buyer will normally pay a commission on sales that are retained by the buyer. And these numbers, there's a lot of variability in it. The last two, there wasn't. You know, we see commissions from 3 to 7%. We see 2 to 4 years. If there was an average of averages, we're going to say 3 years at 5%. So this is where a seller gets paid for the goodwill. in almost every instance, in fact, in every instance, the value somebody receives in a tuck-in transactions is much better than closing the doors. So Peter and I will often talk to people, do never, never, never close your doors, because there's always a value out there that will be paid by a buyer that's better than closing your doors.
Not only for in terms of the royalty rate, yeah, but also even the collection of the AR. If you're able to demonstrate to your customers that you're selling the business to an ongoing entity and there's going to be a continuation of work, you're going to collect more of the AR than you would collect if you just shut the doors.
Yeah. Good. And I'm getting a little tight in time, Stuart. I don't know if you have any more questions, but let me just go through one more point. Well, why don't you give me my questions as my my.
No, I think you keep moving along. You're actually answering a lot of the questions as you go along there. So
okay.
Why don't you keep moving?
Okay, so we're talking about the sellers, the benefits and risks of a tuck-in to seller. Well, clearly, the ongoing value. This you're going to receive more value than you would receive otherwise. In many, many cases, the value that a seller receives in a tuck-in is a very, very high multiple of EBITDA, much higher than those multiples we were talking about before. You know, generally speaking, the EBITDA may be less, but you may hear in the market, well, somebody just got paid 12 times EBITDA. Well, nobody paid 12 times EBITDA unless the deal was structured the way we look at it here. So this, it's a good way for a seller to realize good money for his or her company when there's a high level of assets involved in the business. The risk to a seller here is that they get paid some portion of the proceeds over time, and you got to make sure that the buyer stays in business during that period. For the buyer, it's a fairly good deal. It's a way to buy business. It's a way to augment their sales and to grow in markets or much quicker than the markets are growing. It's the risk here are implementations, and we would always recommend that you have a buyer has somebody totally focused on the implementation of any acquisition, but particularly a tuck-in. So it's very, very important that that goes on. I'm going to spend just a few seconds on a third type of transaction, and it's a transaction that we hear a lot of people talking about, a lot of people involved in them. It tends to fall down on the weight of not the economics, not is it good for the customers, not if it's good for the employees, but falls down because who's in charge, what's the name on the door, what are the corporate governance rules going forward. But essentially a cashless merger is if two companies get together and based on the relative value of their businesses going into the merger, they have that value going forward post-closing. So there's a shared ownership of the company afterwards, and agreeing on those provisions is usually what slows down the implementation of these, and then sometimes, in fact, doesn't get done. But nonetheless, we must say that for people that are committed to our business, you love printing as we do, and you need to strengthen your business and don't have the money to buy somebody, cashless merger is a great thing to do. So the benefits of the cashless merger, just as I referred to, compelling economics, little or no cash needed to get the business done, and the risk are what I have alluded to in the past. It's it's difficult to implement it and agree on how the business is going to be managed going forward. This particular slide I now have up is the benefits of a consolidation, and this is where you see the power of companies like ours, like our printing companies, that have a high component of fixed costs. In this particular example, we're showing a company that has the buyer is a company with $5 million in sales, has pre-tax income about 2.5%, not that unusual. It buys a firm that's about 40% of its size. We assume that a 75% of the sales are, in fact, retained. I will tell you that if you do it right, this number can be 95%. But the bottom line here is that a company that was a bit of a trailer in profits at 2.5% actually almost increases their pre-tax income by three times by taking a company and buying it and moving it into its location. This is the magic of absorbing fixed costs over more sales dollars.
And what's even more beautiful, in my opinion at least, is it's growing that three times in margin, and the company it acquired was losing money.
Yeah. So I'm going to pass it back to Peter now.
So in terms of what's happening and what we anticipate to happen. In printing, I think very few people would argue that the printing industry is in a state of decline, contraction. Doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of companies that are going to make money or that can make money in a declining market, but the PIA itself is estimating that by 2018, the industry is going to have shrunk by 15% from today. So during a period of contraction, it just makes the organic growth so hard to come by, and that's why within printing, we have seen a number of tuck-in opportunities that have been occurring, and then also more recently as the industry has gotten a little healthier and rebounded from where it was in 2009, we're seeing more and more of the EBITDA-based cash at closing type transactions. So we are seeing more and more transactions within the industry. And again, one fairly new phenomenon that we have seen is strong interest in companies that have a proprietary technology. If they are able to generate program business in which they're able to control data and generate customer loyalty, that is driving a lot of interest in terms of M&A. On the packaging side, there is no doubt that we have seen tremendous M&A activity over the last few years, and it seems to be growing each year, and it's just a sign of the health of the industry and the growth that's being generated. Both interest on the strategic side and the private equity side. And in 2013, we were seeing multiples on average even north of six times, approaching 6.5 times. And that is back to exceeding levels that were occurring before the economic downturn in 2009. So in terms of what we expect to happen, we just think – Not that you believe in this saying, but the stars have aligned, and we're seeing very strong M&A activity in both industries, and we expect that to continue. It's being driven by improved stock prices of the public companies, record levels of private equity money out there, and relatively encouraging economic growth forecasts. We don't anticipate a slowdown in any of those. And as a result, we expect M&A to continue. There are a number of publicly traded companies in both printing and packaging that they're being rewarded on Wall Street because of their growth forecasts. And a key component of their achieving their growth forecasts is their ability to demonstrate that they can close on transactions. Companies like Donnelley, Quad, Symveo, Rock 10, Bemis, and Multicolor have all demonstrated the ability to grow through acquisition, and as a result are trading at attractive multiples, and we expect that to continue. We expect strategic buyers to continue to have interest for the tuck-ins in particular. If you're not a seller today, you're almost crazy not to be looking for a tuck-in when you see what it can do to your bottom line as we showed just a few slides ago. And also one point that we talked about earlier, 5 years ago, private equity had little to no interest in anything to do with the printing industry. The printing industry was really blacklisted. And that is changing today. Just yesterday, I had a conversation with a private equity group that is acquiring a large company in one of the declining segments in our industry, but they recognize that this company is unique and that it's poised to do well, and they're buying it for a healthy price. We're working on a number of transactions within printing that will go to private equity. So private equity is now, once again, interested in both printing and packaging.
So, Stu, we're getting close to the end, so maybe you could get us some questions. And during that period, I'll just page through some of the last slides, but I think we need to handle some of the audience questions now.
Yeah, I think so, too. That'd be great. You know, actually, just to follow up with your discussion, someone's asking, who are the most active printing company buyers today in the wake of the purchase of Consolidated Graphics? Do you have any – someone wants you to do some name dropping. You already did some name dropping, but maybe if you want to help out, if there's anyone in particular. I haven't found any yet, but I'll let you answer that.
But I think the difference is that, yes, we see in private equity. We just cannot discount. We see private equity coming into the markets. But it's a competitor. There are regional players that are active. So
it
may not be the time for Consolidated Graphics or Senveo in the commercial print markets, but it is local companies, people that are regional. When we come to private equity, we're talking about people that are interested in the lower middle market. So they're out there. There's just no doubt, because they're compelling economics for a regional player to buy in somebody that's close to them.
You know, so many people have asked that question about Consolidated Graphics, but in actuality, I believe Consolidated closed on maybe one transaction within the past 3 years, at least 2 years, before they sold to Donnelly. So they really were not actively acquiring the healthy companies there at the end. So the buyers are out there. If you're sizable enough, you could be attractive to some of the national buyers that we've talked about. But as Paul said, there are a number of regional buyers too.
Let me ask you this. What would you say would be the smallest size company a private equity firm would be interested in? Questions out there.
Well, it's going to be a function of the growth rates. I mean, if it's a fast-growing, let's call it digital-driven business, it could be $2 million because the perception it's going to go quickly. But generally speaking, if you start to get to $2 to $3 million of EBITDA, we can find people. And if you get to $5 million of EBITDA, you run an auction.
Yeah, and it also depends, Stu, on what the objectives are of the private equity firm. If it is to do their initial platform acquisition from which they intend to grow after that, they usually like their first acquisition to be fairly large. But if they already have a company in that space, they'll look at a company almost any size.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. I'm going to switch gears here. Have you ever had a commercial printing company give you an assignment, let's say, to find a digital printing company to help them transition from commercial to digital?
All the time.
So the
attributes of one of the strategic reasons to grow through acquisition is to move into a market where you not now are. So it could be a product of your extension line. It could be an extension of your product line, excuse me. It could be in a new geographical area. The one recommendation we would have here for people looking for that is, if you're moving out of your area of expertise, buy a good company. Don't buy a company that's unhealthy, because it may have bad customer relationships. It may not have the right cost structure. If you're going to move outside of what you know, stay with something that the numbers work. They're a profitable company because it may or may not be in a position to fix it. Where if you know the business, I mean, it's you know, you're a commercial printer, you're a paperboard packaging it, and you know that business and it's not working. Well, you know how to fix it. If you're a commercial printer and you buy a fulfillment company or you buy a data management company because you're in direct mail, you may not know how to fix it.
Just to reiterate, Stu, we see it all the time. We're selling right now a data analytics company to a company that's not in that space. And as Paul said, we always recommend when you do that, you acquire a healthy company.
Yeah.
Well, let's say that you're going to sell your company, but you realize that some of your key employees, specifically maybe plant managers and salespeople, are such an important component of the sale that how do most buyers and sellers approach key employee issues?
You know, frequently we have clients who want to reward their key members of management when they sell their business, and we think that's wonderful. And by the way, buyers think that's wonderful too, because very frequently it can work to the buyer's benefit and the seller's benefit if they can take those proceeds and turn them into a non-compete where the managers are going to agree to stay with the company for a period of time. And it can be a win-win for both the buyer and the seller.
That's great. Another question that's come across is you know, there's these unfunded pension liabilities that go on. Sometimes are reported on balance sheets, sometimes not. We've all dealt with union companies that have union employees who have an unfunded pension liability as well. I guess the person's asking, how do you deal with it?
It's very difficult to sell. Yeah, it's a real problem today, and it's not just printing or packaging. It's in the industry. If you're a union and you have an unfunded pension plan, typically, more often than not, the buyer will require that the seller pay off the unfunded liability so they can exit the pension plan and not have this issue going forward.
So, I mean, just so everybody understands it, for the people on the phone, there was part of ERISA, there was a rule that said that if a multi-employer defined benefit plan ran into trouble, those people that remained in the union or the multi-employer plan would have to pay for any problems that occurred. In most non-union, the pension guaranteed and benefit corporation picks up that risk. So if you are exiting a union, even though you have paid every bill you should have paid to that multi-employer plan, when you exit, if there's an unfunded liability, you may be held accountable for a portion of it. I would say it is a negotiable amount. There are some rules. There's even a law in Congress that may impact this over the next couple of years. But if you are looking to buy companies or you are, in fact, a union company, you should be knowledgeable of what this liability may be. It can almost be a seminar in itself, but it is a very interesting issue.
And the key to what Paul just said, I think, is that it's negotiable. You might be told, for example, you have a $6 million liability. That doesn't mean you have to pay $6 million. You might pay $1 million or $1.5 million, but it is something that you have to be aware of and really proactively deal with.
I got 5 seconds here. One more question. For a tuck-in, is cash ever paid up front from the buyer, of course?
Yes.
Absolutely.
in fact, by definition, it has to cover whatever debt that it has to be paid off as part of the closing. So minimally, to make a tuck-in work, all debt needs to be paid off so all liens can be released on that. So the answer is yes, and normally it's paid. I don't know if I could think of one where it wasn't.
This is where we said earlier the buyer needs to be creative. And, yes, the buyer needs to show up at the table with cash. Sometimes it can be credited against the future royalty payments. Actually, most times I would say it ought to be credited against future payments. But, yes, the buyer will likely need to show up with cash.
Well, I just can't do it for what you've done. It looks like we're out of time today and on behalf of Direction Partners and Print Impressions and Package Printing. I want to thank everybody for attending today's webinar. I thought it was fantastic, and I want to just thank Peter and Paul for joining us today. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Stuart.
Thank you, Stuart.